This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've heard that human violence is on the rise. It's on the wane. It's hardwired. It's learned. Which one is it? Maybe all of them. For centuries, philosophers have debated whether we humans are noble savages, quick to lend a hand and empathize with a neighbor, or whether we're more like our animal relatives, ready to maim or kill if it improves our lot. What do we really know about human violence? Where it comes from? How to stop it? What can the latest science and years of blood-soaked history tell us about human nature? Well, this hour, we're going to look at the origins of mankind's most troubling characteristic. Is violence inborn? What role does violent entertainment now play in actual violence? Can understanding where violence comes from help us stop it? My guests today have all had deep thoughts about this. Let me introduce them. Dr. Steven Pinker is professor of psychology at Harvard, author of The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Welcome back to Science Friday, Stephen.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Richard Wrangham is professor of biological anthropology at Harvard and co-author of the book Demonic Males, Apes and the Origins of Human Violence. Welcome back to the program, Richard.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You're welcome. Harold Schechter is professor of American literature at Queens College in New York. He's a true crime writer specializing in serial killers and the author of the book Savage Pastimes, A Cultural History of Violent Entertainment. Welcome to Science Friday, Harold.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're welcome. Let's define some terms. Stephen, let me start with you. How do you define violence?
Well, the intentional infliction of harm to another sentient creature, embracing murder, assault, robbery, kidnapping, and rape, whether carried out by individuals or groups.
Mm-hmm. If a two-year-old cannot inflict any harm on anybody, Is he committing any kind of violence? If he acts out and screams and does all those temper tantrums?
I would say yes. We don't have to get caught up on the semantics of the term violence, but clearly psychologically he or she's trying to inflict harm, so sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Stephen and Richard, you'll be speaking about violence tomorrow at the ASU Origins Project. Let's get right into this issue. Are humans predisposed to be violent? Has science answered this question? Let me begin with Richard first.
Well, I mean, what you have to acknowledge is that if humans are in an anarchical state where there is no power, whether it's the police or the government or a king, stopping people from being violent, then there's no question that there's a tremendous tendency for people to express themselves violently at times. So it's not just that people have to be encouraged to be violent. It certainly emerges spontaneously. If you look at hunters and gatherers around the world, those that are in contact with neighboring hunter-gatherer societies of different languages are always found to be so violent with each other that there are frequent kills of each other at their borders. So there's no doubt in my mind that violence has a long history in humans.
And the nature and nurture question, do you think it's hardwired, more hardwired than learned?
What is rather dramatic about the human patterns in hunter-gatherers is the similarity that they show to chimpanzees. And the reason that's of interest is because chimpanzees and humans clearly differ from in the degree of socialization. Humans socialize each other. Chimps certainly don't do so with any kind of deliberate intent. And yet, in both species, what you find is that there is a tendency for males to get into small groups, and if they encounter a stranger from the neighbors, they will deliberately hunt them down and kill them. So that suggests to me that there is a lot of inherent propensity for violence in humans, and that what we see nowadays is a suppression of that.
Stephen Pinker, that's one of the themes of your book, is that we are less violent today than humans used to be.
That's right. And the entire question, is violence hardwired or can it be affected by the environment, is the wrong kind of question, because it doesn't have an either-or answer. We're not blank slates, but we're not wind-up dolls that are insensitive to our environment and just go walking into walls either. And that's also true of violence. As Richard pointed out, you can certainly have violence in humans and other species without social encouragement to do so. On the other hand, we don't just commit violence willy-nilly. We're not like the Tasmanian devil that just rips through the countryside, leaving a swath of destruction in our wake, come what may. We assess our environment and can modulate our tendency toward violence, or our tendencies, because violence is not one thing. There are a number of different reasons that people will harm one another. Each one of them is sensitive to the environment in a different way. There's just sheer exploitation, harming someone who's an obstacle in the path to something that you want, where there the main impediment is simply whether you have any empathy whatsoever for the inconvenient victims. Then there's dominance, the contests in many species, more often among males than females, in violent confrontations for who climbing the pecking order and becoming alpha. There's revenge. When do you think that violence is not just permissible, but mandatory? You shouldn't let someone get away with a sin or an infraction. Each one of these kinds of violence is sensitive to our assessment of our environment in different ways. And yes, we have changed our environments to make violence less likely, even though the tendencies are still there.
Mm-hmm. Harold, in your book, Savage Pastimes, you looked at violent entertainment throughout history.
Yes.
And what did you find? We would seem to think that with all the violence we have in video games and things, that we are in a very violent entertainment period.
Well, popular culture has always been incredibly violent. I mean, part of the thesis of my book, which looks very, very closely at the history of mass-produced popular entertainment, is that, contrary to what many people believe, the popular entertainments of the past were often far more savage and brutal than the violent video games that have come under such assault from moral crusaders nowadays. And in fact, I take the kind of violence you find in Grand Theft Auto and these other shoot 'em up games to actually be a very, very positive sign of our increasing civilization, because in the not-too-distant past, people derived a great deal of pleasure from going and seeing actual human beings being subjected to torture and execution. You know, one of the examples I use in my book is the movie Braveheart. At the end of the movie Braveheart, Mel Gibson, playing the Scottish hero William Wallace, is tortured and killed. In the movie, you really don't get to see anything. You just get to see Mel Gibson sort of strung up in this picturesque way that shows off his musculature to handsome advantage, and then the camera cuts away to the actual brutality. When William Wallace, the real historical William Wallace, was executed. It took hours and hours and hours, and he was subjected to the most hideous kinds of atrocities imaginable in front of a large, very appreciative audience. So, you know, I take that as a very, very healthy sign. That the bad news is human beings still require violent entertainment. The good news is we are now willing to settle for it in simulated forms.
Do we pay any price? We don't pay any price then?
I would say on the contrary. Not only do we pay a price, but we reap many social and personal and psychological rewards. You know, I'm in agreement with both Richard and Stephen. You know, William James spoke of human beings' primordial instinct for bloodshed and cruelty. I feel that we are innately violent creatures who have to be socialized, and that when you find characters like the serial killers I write about, those people are the products of a failure of socialization, and that popular entertainment, the reason popular entertainment isn't, has always been so violent is, you know, that it affords a social safety valve for the innately violent fantasies of normal law-abiding people. I think it helps keep society on an even psychological keel. You know, Plato said, Plato said, the virtuous man is content to dream what the wicked man really does. And I believe that popular culture affords, again, law-abiding, well-brought-up people who would never in their real lives commit an act of criminality or violence, a kind of a way to ventilate those repressed impulses.
Mm-hmm. Our number is 844-7. Let me just get the number, please. Please, I'd love you to jump in. 844-724-8255. Yeah, Harold, jump in.
Oh, that wasn't me.
I'm sorry, Richard. Richard, jump in. Yeah.
This is Richard, I was loving Harold's account of the role of entertainment violence, as it were. But I noticed a sort of sanitized version in relationship to the sexes or the genders. Mm. He was talking about people, and of course, if we're going to talk about violence, we really have to acknowledge that it is men or boys who are responsible for the great majority of it.
Yes,
I think wondered. Right. Yeah, I was just wondering about entertainment in history with regard to entertaining men or women.
Well, you know, I mean, I think if you historically look at the makeup of the audiences for executions and so on, I mean, there were at least as many women as there were men. And one of the things that's very interesting to me as a writer of historical crime stories is that every time there has been a very sensational murder, most of the spectators who occupy the seats in the courtroom are women. So I think there's an attraction among women to violent fantasies as well. I would also say, in general, you know, the function of pop art, again, is to allow people to exercise or ventilate these taboo, socially unacceptable fantasies, and that doesn't have only to do with violence. I mean, if you look at a phenomenon like 50 Shades of Grey, you see that it also has to do with allowing them to indulge in, you know, very, very forbidden sexual fantasies that they would not permit themselves to enact in life.
Richard, what about the gender in chimp violence? You studied that. What
do we see? It's incredibly dramatic.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, you have the opportunity to follow small groups of chimpanzees as they go on these so-called border patrols, where it's quite clear that their activity is not to do with their regular maintenance. They're not there to feed. They're not there to even to look for food. What they're there to do is to look for opportunities to kill members of neighboring groups or harm them so badly that they die. And sometimes you get females joining in these in the sense that they travel with the males, but normally the females drop off before they get to the edge. And even if a female occasionally, one without a child normally, is there actually at the time that the males succeed in stalking, hunting, and grabbing a member of the neighboring group, all the males pile in, but she doesn't. She might run around getting excited. So it's absolutely clear that it is a male phenomenon that is responsible for the typical pattern of this extraordinary, deliberate imposition of harm.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Stephen Pinker, Harold Schechter, Richard Wrangham. Has the nature of the kind of violence changed? And let me just throw this out, and not in any political way. And we're willing to accept 40,000 deaths every year by firearms. We're willing to accept an equal 30,000, 40,000 deaths a year by cars. There are tens of thousands of people dying other ways. They never died these ways. The firearms weren't there, the cars weren't there, other diseases or whatever that we might be able to prevent. Is that not violence, you know, that is in a change way than it used to be? And little Stephen, if you measure it that way, is violence not on the rise?
No, it's definitely not on the rise. In fact, homicide statistics go back hundreds of years in many parts of the world, and whenever you plot them over time, you see massive declines in any area that's come under the control of a state. So in England, for example, the homicide rate now is about 1/35 what it was in the Middle Ages. Even in the United States, the first areas that were settled in any part of the country would have extremely high rates of violence until they were brought under state control, until the frontier was closed. And you don't need a gun to kill people. Since we're a hunting species, anything that we can use to kill an animal, we can use to kill a member of our species. Anyone who has the tools to make salad has the tools to stab another person to death. So certainly guns can exacerbate the likelihood of violence, but human violence is not primarily about guns.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, and by the way, when it even comes to the unintentional violence on the highway, the rate of death in traffic accidents has fallen by a sixth per passenger mile since the 1950s. So there seems to be a general increased valuation of human life, which is manifested both in reductions in intentional harm, but also in unintentional harm. We've tried to make the world safer so that we trade off other conveniences in order to have a lower chance of coming to a violent end.
Mm-hmm. There was a recent study that showed that in children, when shown violent video games, they seem to become more aggressive after the games. Are you familiar with that?
Yes. So what Harold Schechter said about the beneficial effects of violent entertainment is the opposite of the consensus among my fellow psychologists. But I actually think that Harold is right and my fellow psychologists are wrong. There's a huge effort, largely moralistic, among psychologists to stigmatize violent entertainment. I don't think the research is very good at showing that. And in fact, the bulk of the research shows that although more violent people might be attracted to more violent entertainment, and if you show kids a Roadrunner cartoon, they may run around a little more and hit a Bobo doll more often. Mm-hmm. But in terms of affecting violence in real life, I don't think there's good evidence that violent entertainment makes people more violent.
Yeah, I mean, one of the points that I made one of the reasons I wrote my book is that I'm a baby boomer. I mean, all I and my contemporaries did was play with guns.
The westerns,
and you know, those were,
yeah.
You know,
I remember. Yeah.
I mean, talk about gratuitous violence. I mean, every episode of Gunsmoke started with Marshall Dillon pulling out his gun and shooting out some faceless guy. He didn't even know for what reason. There was this fetishizing of guns. You know, Have Gun Will Travel, which was the number one TV show for several seasons. You know, would begin with a close up of Paladin's, you know, custom made Colt 45. We're now living in a culture where, you know, first graders can be kicked out of class because they form their hands into pistols. Whereas again, I and all my contemporaries did nothing but run around shooting each other, and you know, we did not grow up to be a generation of violent people. So.
All right, let me take a break. We'll come back and talk about some more about the history of violence, and maybe get some questions in for our listeners. Talking with Steven Pinker, Harold Schechter, Richard Wrangham, and you can tweet us at Facebook at SciFry if you'd like. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. In case you joined us, you're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about violence, and we're talking with Steven Pinker, professor of psychology at Harvard, Richard Wrangham, professor of biological anthropology at Harvard, and Harold Schechter, a true crime author and professor of American literature at Queens College in New York. Let me get a phone call in here because it's kind of interesting if I can figure out what press the button on this one. Let's go to, is it Cass in Baton Rouge?
Yes, Cass.
Yes, hi, go ahead.
I heard him talking about the Grand Theft Auto video game and how that might help people vent by playing these violent video games. And it just made me think about professional wrestling. Do you think that would help people? How does that fit in? You know, it's people watching these performers that are obviously, it's not real, it's fake violence, but a lot of people go to these shows and a lot of people watch it on TV every week. Do you think professional wrestling fits in at all?
I just think there's this vast human appetite for violent spectacle, and you have to ask yourself why so much, not only of popular entertainment, but great art, you know, is so rife with violence. You know, what exactly is that appealing to in the audience? And, you know, again, from my point of view, and I think, again, from what Stephen and Richard have been insisting on, you know, is that we are, on some level, creatures born of violence. You know, Robert Ardrey, this one critic who wrote a very influential book called African Genesis, says we weren't born of fallen angels, we were born of risen apes, and those apes are armed killers besides, and that's still part of our makeup. And, you know, in order to satisfy that carnivore within, to use another phrase of Henry James, you know, we turn to all of these spectacles, whether it's wrestling or video games or, for that matter, Shakespeare's King Lear, as a way of ventilating some of these impulses that we deny in ourselves.
So we need a sort of an outlet
exactly.
To play these games. We need an outlet. We need some way to act these things out without hurting people by going to wrestling, watching it, knowing it's fake.
Absolutely.
Yes, an interesting development in violent entertainment is that as it is more gruesome and bloody on the surface, it's actually safer and safer in terms of actual harm done. So you can go to the Cinemaplex and watch this, you know, splatterfest of gore and violence and pain and torture, and at the end of the movie it says no animals were harmed in the making of this motion picture. Or even in simulated fights or real fights in mixed martial arts and wrestling, it looks pretty awful. But as those have been increasing in popularity, boxing has decreased, and the object of boxing is basically to give the other guy brain damage. Boxing is much more destructive than the pretty superficial flesh wounds that you might get in mixed martial arts. And so I think that as we get better at depicting gruesome violence, we're simultaneously reducing real violence.
Richard Wrangham, you agree with this?
Yes, that all sounds fine, but again, I'm interested in the sex differences. Harold was saying that women are really interested in the depiction of violence, and that's a fascinating observation. I wonder about the extent to which their behavior is affected by it. Steve thinks that there isn't going to be much effect on either sex, but I am aware of studies which show that actually chimpanzees watching violence or babies watching violence are more likely to be violent if they're male after being exposed to depictions of violence or actual violence, whereas females may be interested but don't change their behavior. I'm not sure how well that stands up as a generalization, but it would seem to me that we have to come back to the notion that it is males who are predisposed by their evolutionary background to take advantage of opportunities to be violent.
What's that famous phrase, all the world's troubles can be traced back to the inability of men to sit quietly in a room? Is that what you're saying?
Pretty much any quantitative measure of violence will show a sex difference with males the more violent sex. Men fantasize more about violence, they consume more violent entertainment, they commit more violence. Although in none of the cases is the rate of violence for women zero. So women certainly can be violent, they're less likely to be. And I suspect that if you were to subdivide violence into different psychological kinds, and I believe that violence is not a single category, that there'd be different kinds that men and women would engage in. When it comes to just sheer instrumental violence, just you need to get rid of something to increase your own safety or the safety of your family, or you want something and there's a nuisance, I don't think the sex difference would be as large as pure contests over dominance. What I genteelly call competitive distance urination, where the gender with the apparatus that allows them to compete is the gender that is more likely to get involved in such contests.
You know, I just want to toss in here. I write books about serial killers, and the question of whether there are female serial killers is, you know, one that is of much interest to people in my field. Camille Paglia says there are no female Jack the Rippers, which is true. That kind of very aggressive phallic sexual mutilation murder is strictly a male phenomenon, but there have been many, many, many women who commit sadistic kinds of serial killing. They just do it in different ways. They tend to be poisoners, for example.
Black Widow.
And it's interesting, they also tend to mostly prey on acquaintances and intimates and family members, as opposed to going around and trolling for strangers the way a lot of male serial killers do. So there certainly seems to be a capacity for sadistic behavior among women. And as I said, I mean, there are many, many, many cases of female serial poisoners, some of whom have killed many more people than male serial killers.
Mm-hmm. I think it's all wonderful.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's rather wonderful that we're in a time in our history when we can afford to really focus on those rare individuals. You know, those that we might think of as psychopaths or pathological in some ways, the serial killers. Because if we go back into not too long ago, basically everybody was violent. Mm-hmm. You know, if you think about life in hunter-gatherers only 10,000 years ago, then there weren't any men who systematically said, you know, I'm a peace-loving guy. They would all go on the raids. They would all be involved in killing each other. And now we're at this wonderful moment in history where we expect each other to be non-violent. Mm-hmm. And it's the rare cases that are violent.
Let's go to the phones to Alan on Long Island. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how you doing? Yeah, you may have already answered my question when you started talking about sports, because I kind of think of competition as being kind of integral to the conversation. I mean, when I think about early men, you know, they competed for food with each other, with other animals. People competed for mates. So, you know, just the high degree. I'd like you guys, if maybe you'd like to comment on the role of competition terms of violence.
Well, one of the dramatic things, I think, about the commonalities between chimpanzees and hunter-gatherers living in a world of hunter-gatherers is that you actually don't need any immediate source of competition to precipitate the violence. What you want is a sufficient power difference that one group is able to kill members of a neighboring group without any risk of themselves being harmed. In other words, suppose that we're in a group of hunters and gatherers, or it could be chimpanzees, and life is good for us, and we can afford to go and spend time checking our boundaries, then all we need to do is to just see a member of the neighboring group in order to be able to have the satisfaction of killing them. So it's not that they're fighting over a female or over a food resource. Very often what they're doing is simply taking advantage of their power. That's the kind of horrendous background you've got to think of in terms of the propensity for violence.
And there's a famous experiment that every psychology undergraduate is exposed to called the Robber's Cave Study, in which two groups of mentally healthy 11-year-old boys were sent off to camp, and the counselors, who were really graduate students in psychology, wanted to look at their forms of violent competition, and they found that before they even had them competing over any resource, before they even met each other, they just heard each other in the distance, they were itching to compete. There's nothing to compete over, but just the presence of another group of boys was enough to get their juices flowing.
Speaking of getting juices flowing, Harold Schechter, in your new book, The Mad Sculptor, mm-hmm. you describe violent stories that grab our attention. Could I get you to read a passage for us?
Well, one of the early chapters begins, to become a true tabloid sensation, a murder has to offer more than morbid titillation. It needs a pair of outsized characters, diabolical villain and defenseless, preferably female victim, a dramatic storyline, and the kind of lurid goings-on that speak to the secret dreams and dangerous desires of the public. And, you know, I go on to talk about this one mm-hmm. tabloid case that gripped the country as opposed to the dozens of other equally lurid murders that were going on at the time. But again, this kind of relates to the last caller. I mean, to me, one of the inspiring things about our species, you know, is that we have learned to transform these very, very savage, primitive impulses into kinds of games, into stories. Obviously, you know, talking about sports, something like football, you know, it's all a game about territorial aggression and so on and so forth. You know, but again, we turn these things into pastimes, into forms of make-believe. We sublimate them into socially acceptable and even socially beneficial kind of activities. So, I mean, I'm a glasses half-full kind of guy. Yeah. But I see all of the violence in the culture that surrounds us. I mean, the make-believe violence is actually a very, very positive sign of this civilizing process.
What about people who say that the make-believe violence, just like you were describing, we were describing the murders that happened before, mm-hmm. are not gory enough as they are in real life? And if people really saw the kind of real kinds of violence, what the blood, the gore, whatever, that really happens, they might think twice about being as violent. Or is there any research that shows that?
I mean, one of the things, again, I think if you know, for all the talk about realistic violence in the media, I mean, it's very, very stylized. It's nothing like real violence. You know, sometimes, I once in my life was on a city bus in New York City and saw the police shoot a guy, and the guy just collapsed, you know, just fell down. I mean, he wasn't doing this balletic slow motion bloodbath kind of thing. I can't watch documentaries about women giving birth, see all these, I'm a big Walking Dead fan or whatever, but so, yeah, there isn't much of a correlation between those two things.
Yes,
Stephen, but let me just jump in and say, I'm Ira Plato, and this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International.
Yes,
hey, Bill, Stephen, go ahead.
Most real-life episodes of violence are nothing like the roaring fisticuffs in Deadwood Gulch. But the way I described it is more like a two-minute penalty for roughing in a boring hockey game, mm-hmm. where two men will kind of clutch and grab, fall to the floor, maybe a fist will emerge from a mutual embrace. It's all actually quite boring. When there are dramatic scenes of real-life violence that are interpreted as real-life violence, they can be effective, and it's not implausible to think that some of the anti-war sentiments that have arisen over the last half century were facilitated by the fact that wars are televised. In World War I, the British government censored battlefield photographs because they were probably quite rightly concerned that if people saw what was happening on the battlefield, it would dash their image of glorious combat and turn them against the conduct of the war. Vietnam was the first televised war, and some of the unforgettable images, like the naked girl running from the napalm attack or the Viet Cong soldier shot in cold blood by a police officer, probably did have a role in turning many Americans away from the war, and we're seeing that even more now when every person is a reporter. Anyone with a smartphone can beam footage to the web almost in real time. We're concerned about violence in places of the world that we didn't really care about several decades ago, but I think a lot depends on how it's framed. It's not just that if you see blood, if you see fisticuffs, that automatically makes you more or less violent. We interpret what we see. We think about the real world events in which they did or didn't take place, and that's really what governs our reaction to violence.
If we grow up with violence in our home, does that affect whom we become?
A lot of things tend to go together. If you grow up with violence in the home, unless you're adopted, you have also inherited the genes of the people committing that violence, so it isn't so easy to tease apart nature and nurture in those cases. You're also likely to grow up in a violent neighborhood, and your fate among your peers and your interests on the street are going to depend on your willingness to carry out violence. So a lot of things tend to go together. I suspect that the peer environment in the neighborhood is a more potent factor than what your parents did once you subtract the genetic contribution. So it is environmental. It's not necessarily parental.
By the way, thinking about the way that violence is portrayed in the media, we've been talking about it's more gory or different from the way that it occurs in representations in the public. But there's also another way in which it differs, and that is that the style of violence that is often portrayed is two sides coming together and willingly grappling with each other, either as individuals at the end of the movie or in battles. You know, there's the Braveheart scene where two sides are roaring towards each other, full of enthusiasm to get into the fight. That is completely unrealistic. The way that violence tends to happen is by people avoiding direct confrontation and waiting until they can commit the violence from a safe perspective. And in fact, there was a wonderful study over 100 years ago of what happens when armies are sent towards each other, and very often they just slide past each other and don't hit each other at all, or they stop before they can get within the range of their weapons. So you know, people are much less willing to engage in violence than the media represent.
We have to leave it there. I'll let you guys discuss it more at Arizona State University. Stephen Pinker, professor of psychology at Harvard. Richard Wrangham, professor of biological anthropology at Harvard. Harold Schechter, true crime author, professor of American literature at Queens College. Thank you all for joining us today. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to Bob Isaacson and our production partners at the studios at the City University of New York. And if you missed any of our program and you'd like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcast, audio and video, point your tablet, your smartphone to our website at sciencefriday.com. We tweet all week at SciFry, and if you like us on Facebook. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.